show me what I fear, so I don't fear it no more.
Welcome everybody to another episode of Horror Makes You Brave. Same repeat guest I've had on before today, and we're doing kind of another different sort of thing. But before we get into it, welcome Darwin.
Darwin again, huh? Well, I go by my real name Vuk now, but we can stick to Darwin because this is the third time I'm on your show, because apart from me and Matt, you don't have any friends.
I got MJ. Screw you. I got Kristen. Well, I got Luke. Episodes... What are you talking about?
Luke. Okay.
Whenever we recorded last time with Frankenstein, I think it was like right before we recorded or right after you pitched the idea of Goosebumps.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's a great idea, because that's fitting for this show. And then sort of because usually you want to pick something obscure. But you picked Goosebumps. I was like, that's a great idea. And then I picked the book that I wanted to read. And apparently it's not one of the most well-known. You were like, well, that's an obscure. We're like, why would you pick that one?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, it's my favorite. And I hadn't read it in, like, it has been over 20 years since I've read this book. By the way, it's Goosebumps, The Haunted School that we're doing, if you didn't know by the title. And this was like, whenever you mentioned Goosebumps and I said, let's do The Haunted School, I remember, like, I think I riffed off almost the entire plot to you as much as I could recall it, which is saying something, because I hadn't read it in like 20 some years, and I explained almost the entire plot. And then as I was kind of, you know, I read it back then, and then this time I realized it was free to listen to on YouTube. So that's what I did. But you read it.
Oh, yeah. So I'm going to make fun of you now. I used to be a teacher. For the audience. So right now we are doing essentially Landon doing his book report assignment yeah. to me. And as I may imagine a lot of students nowadays do with book reports, they turn it in and did not read the book, but rather listened to it. You did not even listen to an audiobook. You listened to some shitty narration on YouTube.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is technically the audiobook. It was recorded for, I mean, it didn't have like the great Audible quality that they all have these days. Like it was recorded in like 1998, because by the way, the book came out in like 97. This was recorded in 98. And since audiobooks weren't a huge thing back then, it was specifically recorded right at the end when I was listening. Like it was done more for like the visually impaired. Mm-hmm. It was basically done for like blind people. But yeah, it's on, if you want to listen to it, it's on YouTube. It's a 2-hour listen, but it's not like it's a hard read anyway. Is the book even like 120 pages or something like that?
Well, I can't know, because I am almost blind. So I use very big fonts for eBooks. Mine was 220 pages because of the large fonts.
So yeah, but so that would equal to probably about 100 some pages, because all of the Goosebumps books, like before we even really get into this one, if you were a child that grew up in the 90s, like Goosebumps was the brand in terms of like books kids actually wanted to, like before there was ever Harry Potter, before the books that kids wanted to read, the closest you could get to forcing kids to actually want to read was getting a Goosebumps book. And the marketing for these books is, because all the books are so brightly colored, they just pop. They're so easy to find and so easy to see. And I'm sure that was a deliberate thing.
And they have that 90s theme of drooping slime.
Yeah.
That's what attracted me. And I'm not really a 90s kid, because I was born in 93, but I remember like those days, slime and extreme and all that stuff was the craze. And I still cling to it.
I mean, that's the heyday of Nickelodeon too. And yeah. That was their thing, is the slime.
Oh yeah. And the animation on MTV, those weird ass psychedelic ones, if you can remember.
That for everyone that remembers so fondly of the 80s, people tend to forget like the 90s had some trippy interesting stuff that was distinctly different from the 80s. That's a little harder to put your thumb on in terms of like, why the hell did people love this? Because the 80s you sort of see because everything's
neon.
neon and blown up. But the 90s just had these weird alternative like type stuff, from the music to the movies to this kind of stuff.
And isn't it funny that me and you keep on creating content around 90s stuff? We did The X-Files, now we're doing Goosebumps.
Yeah. Not so much because I, at least for me, I'm a kid of the 90s. Yeah. I mean, I was born in 86, but everything I know is mostly from the 90s.
I should be fair. I grew up in Canada in the late 90s and early 2000s, and Canada is like 5 years late to the party.
Yeah. Again, like they had I don't know if they did more than one, but like a few years ago, they had a movie called Goosebumps come out, yeah. But it was more retro and it was more nostalgia based. Like R.L. Stine was a character in the movie. I didn't see it. I just remember looking at it and I was like, I have no interest in watching this. It looked so cheesy. It's so cool. Like it didn't, for something that came out in the 90s, a lot of it just didn't feel 90s. It felt like early 2000s, like kind of silly Disney, like yeah, the Haunted Mansion kind of stuff.
The movie is actually like the Scooby-Doo movie, if you remember that one when it came out.
Okay. Did you see this movie?
Yeah. I liked the Goosebumps movie just because of nostalgia and because I am a fan of Goosebumps. So I got all the references. They inserted at it least one Jack reference Black to every book. Right? Yeah. Jack Black was R.L. Stine in the movie. But R.L. Yeah. Stine appears as a character, I think.
And by the way, R.L. Stine is a rough looking chap. Good Lord. Like he looks like a creepy character from his own books. Like he is. And you know, for everybody that talks about like Stephen King being very prolific, R.L. Stine was churning out these Goosebumps books like back to back to
every
back
month,
to back.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not only just Goosebumps, he also had Fear Street, which is for a little bit older kids. And then I feel like there was another series he did. Like he was like just, I mean, it must have eaten away his soul doing this because the man looks so old and decrepit, even back then and especially now.
And you know what? He also did a lot of horror novels for adults as well.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, it's not just children's stuff. But from what I know, he used to be a writer for comedy before going into horror.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Is he still putting out stuff today?
Yeah, he is. Also, he does not look like somebody you want your children around.
Yeah, he's a creepy looking man. God bless him. But if you look up R.L. Stine, you're just like, good Lord. Like he almost has that, what's his name from Scary Movie 2 with the little hand look to him. Oh, he's kind of got that long sort of balding hair and he's got this like big mole on his face and he's never smiling, by the way. Every photo of him, he just looks like a big frown, looks miserable. So it's amazing that they got Jack Black to play him in the movie. I was like, that doesn't make sense at all, but whatever. But yeah, Goosebumps was everywhere in the 90s, not just books. They made a TV show. I don't know if they ever did The Haunted School as an episode. I doubt it.
So they did a remake of the show last year. And they did an episode of The Haunted School for it. I did not watch it. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to check that out.
And it's not just Goosebumps. There are a lot of different TV shows based on his works. There was the R.L. Stine's Haunting Hour, I think, a few years back.
Huh.
There was also this cool thing in the 2000s. There was a series of Goosebumps books, which were kind of choose your own adventure as well.
Oh, yeah. Those were cool. I forgot all about those. And now that's become kind of its own. I wonder if he started that, Choose Your Own.
I don't think so. I think maybe in the 70s, you know, when Sword and Sandal, Sorcery, whatever, fantasy stuff, D&D stuff was popular. I think there were a few novels, but themed around fantasy.
I remember the tagline, because it was always reader beware, you're in for a scare for the TV show. It was viewer beware, you're in for a scare. And then for the choose your own, it was reader beware, you choose the scare.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about the choose.
Also, own, like so. The marketing behind Goosebumps. I mean, it was everywhere. You even had lunch boxes with Goosebumps.
I mean, characters. It was huge.
Yeah.
Like the way people sort of, I mean, the closest thing I have, I guess, is kind of Harry Potter in terms of the marketing and the merchandise that was made off of it. Kind of went next level with Harry Potter, but it was the 90s Goosebumps really set that up.
The Goosebumps actually screamed 90s because it used all of these neon colors. It used the slime, the drooping motif, all of that 90s stuff.
And like I said, there was a show. I haven't revisited the show because I bet it doesn't hold up.
No, it's a piece of shit.
But I remember the big, I don't know if it was the premiere episode, but it was the big like episode everyone remembers is The Haunted Mask.
Yeah.
Which is one of the more popular books. And I remember because I had the VHS of that. Because that for my birthday that year, my mom asked what I wanted for my birthday, and I had three videotapes that I wanted. I don't remember what the third one was, but the first one was the movie Heavyweights.
Why?
The kids, because I love that movie. To this day, I love that movie. It's so funny. It's still funny. And it's the first like Judd Apatow movie that nobody talks about because people are stupid, but he wrote that movie.
That's such a random choice.
Yeah, but I love that one. But I was like, I want Heavyweights and I want The Haunted Mask. And I don't know where my mom went and found, because again, we live kind of in the middle of nowhere. But somehow she pulled it off. So I might still have it. I have to go check my old VHS collection. I bet I still have
Haunted Mask. And for VHS. Those who do not know what a VHS is.
Come on, man. They have to know. Even if you didn't have one, you should know what a videotape is.
Oh, you know how in video games they use for the save icon floppy disk? And these new Zoomer generations now don't know what the fuck a floppy disk is. So they always, when they see a floppy disk or an image of it, they say, oh, that's the save icon.
Yeah, I guess I never thought about that. Kids these days are looking at that like, that's the save icon. They have no idea what it actually is. Fucking kids, man.
Marketing. The thing with this book, when you told me about it, I wasn't even aware of the book before you told me, because The Haunted School, such a generic title, and you know how every book has amazing artwork, and that's the selling point of every book. This book's artwork is kind of crap.
it's bland, I guess, because the title's bland.
Yeah.
So the artwork is just kind of a locker with stuff spewed out from it.
Yeah.
It's nothing special.
Okay.
I don't know why I even decided to read it.
Did you notice in the locker three sets of eyes?
I don't know about three sets of eyes.
I did not notice that until going and reading the actual book now.
Yeah. And I was looking, the tagline of the book is also like,
oh, man.
It's one of those, like, R.L. Stein clearly wasn't in charge of any of the marketing to this, because I'd have to go back and look at taglines for other books, because I bet none of them really match what the story's even about.
Yeah.
Because the tagline of this one, I can't quite recall what it is.
Cause I think it's like, they are watching you study the hard way.
Yeah. It makes almost no sense. I guess you could sort of tie that in. I mean, it's a hell of a stretch, but it's not what you would think when you finish reading this book.
I want to say, like, this book is amazing. It's now one of my most favorite Goosebumps books. But see? I would never have read it if you did not tell me about it, because it's so bland. The cover is bland. The tagline is shit. The title, The Haunted School. I'm not really ever interested in ghost stories, which is ironic because my favorite Goosebumps book is The Ghost Next Door, which is a very ghost story about a ghost of a dead person. No twists there. But this book, guys, if you want to read it and you just look at the book, you're going to think, oh, the story is about a school that has ghosts or poltergeist activity or something. No, the story is bonkers.
It's almost a sci-fi concept. But and so, like, seriously, if you haven't read this book and you're thinking about it, we're going to spoil the whole thing. And seriously, consider reading it unspoiled, because, like, even me, like, even though I recalled most of it, I didn't tell you this. I didn't remember this ending at all. So whenever I got to it, I was like, holy shit. Like, that's the twist. Like, for you saw it coming because we were messaging earlier.
Yeah.
And I was like, just because I guess I thought I knew what the ending of the book was. So I wasn't thinking about it. I was like, oh, I know where this is going. I did not see this coming at all. And when it happened, it's one of those like brilliant, like M. Night Shyamalan, like, well, of course, it was there the whole time.
Yeah, but which ending are you referring to? Because there are multiple endings here, like multiple twists by the end. So
the ending where you realize a certain character isn't a certain thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll get
to it.
I love how the very ending and the very ending twist of this book is so abrupt. Like,
that's the ending I remembered. I didn't remember the little Shyamalan twist right before.
Yeah.
So I was like, whenever that happened, I was like, oh shit. And then I did know exactly what the final little twist was. And it was a wonderful way to sort of end the book.
Yeah. We're going to go there. I love how open-ended it is. Your first gut reaction is, we'll get there.
Yeah. But it starts out like, now you mentioned this and I didn't really know this, or maybe I just never paid attention. Mm-hmm. R.L. Stine, whenever he would write his characters, they seem to always have sort of the same tropes about them.
Yeah.
Like, did you say like divorced parents or something like that?
Not always, but sometimes he would, because this is late 90s, early 2000s. So when you're writing children books for children, of course the characters are going to be children of divorced parents. I love how in this book he constantly says, my father and my new mom, but it's never explained if his real mom passed away or if they're divorced or if this is the mistress that caused the divorce.
Yeah. And it's weird because I forget how old is he? Like 11, 12?
12, 12, like 6th 12. Grade.
Okay. That reads slightly weird of a kid being like, yeah, she's my new mom. And then them never mentioning their actual mom.
Yeah.
You're like, that's a weird way to write something that feels like, I just don't feel like anyone would say something like that, but I don't know.
Also, I wanted to say before we start, so R.L. Stine said that he got the inspiration to write this book because a few kids followed him into a bookstore. He was doing signings or whatever, but it was an adult bookstore. And the kids told him, Mr., like, will you please do a story that concerns a haunted school, because our school is haunted. And they told him the story of their own school being haunted. And he's like, sure. And maybe that's why it's called The Haunted School, because nothing in here is about a haunting or ghosts.
Yeah, like when you get to the end and you sort of realize what's going on. One thing that's great about it is everything you know of what's going on, you only know from the characters in the book, and they could only ever know so much anyway. So, yeah. But it's not, like you said, it's not really a haunted school. It's something different. It's almost Stranger Things-esque.
Yes.
For these new kids, these new generation of kids.
And also to tie into the origin of this, how he got the idea for this book, R.L. Stine is a fucker. He likes to screw over kids. Like, he would say, yeah, I'm going to use that and completely turn it around. I read recently The Cuckoo Clock of Doom, and he was approached by a girl who said, like, she wants him to do a book where she is the character. And he used her name for the character of the sister of the protagonist of the book, but the sister is an asshole. She's like the main villain.
I never read that one. I can't recall how many of his books I actually read. I remember I at least read the first two, Say Cheese and Die.
Yeah, well, that will...
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's what the name of it, whenever I was trying to recall what the name of this book was, because I remembered the story but forgot the title. So all I could remember is the final ending that involves the camera. And I was like, it must be one of the Say Cheese and Die books.
Yeah.
And then when I was looking up the plot to those, I was like, that's not it. That's not it at all. And I think this is going back almost a year now on Twitter, just randomly, someone was like, I was trying to remember the title and I put it out there. I was like, does anyone remember? And I kind of gave the basic plots of it. I was like, anybody remember this Goosebumps? And I think there's a podcast that specifically covers Goosebump books.
I listened to their episode on this book today. It's Calling All Creeps, but there are more Goosebumps podcasts.
Yeah. but they tweeted at me, or they responded. They were like, yeah, that's the haunted school. And I was like, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, whenever you mentioned Goosebumps, I sort of knew the title right offhand, which a year ago I wouldn't have been able to figure out.
Because it's so bland and it has nothing to do with the plot.
Yeah, I could see why people wouldn't. It's the haunted school. It's like, well, there's so many other great, like Say Cheese and Die is a great poppy title for a book.
Oh, yeah. And its cover art is a Polaroid photo of a whole family of skeletons.
Yeah. And yeah, there's just nothing about this one. Like, this is the low key like book that nobody, if you discover it, you're lucky, because not only is it sort of obscure, but it's also like a solidly written story.
Yeah. And you're also unlucky because now you cannot share it with your friends. You're going to tell your friends, oh, I read this awesome Goosebumps book. And they're like, yeah, noob, you're reading that book.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to recommend it to adults, because most adults are just going to be like, Goosebumps, I'm not a child, I'm not reading that anymore.
Yeah.
But it's a great beach book, honestly, because it takes almost no time to read.
And when you mentioned that, so before we start with the actual book, why I like Goosebumps, I am not a fan of horror movies, as I said a few times on your show. I don't like gore. I don't like violence. I am almost 30 now, and I am already I'm already tired of living anyway, so death is not something scary to me. But what is scary is psychological horror, or some weird things happening to you that only you perceive and nobody is believing you. You know, the whole outer world being much more powerful than you, nobody believing you, stuff like that. And those are all the themes that go on into Goosebumps, because they're horror themes that are reserved for little children. But somehow I find them much more terrifying than just, you know, somebody being mutilated and dying.
I want to say when Luke and I, we just recorded, we sort of touched on that at the end, where scary stories are, you know, for adults, we find them a little bit more fun, but it's almost like they were invented specifically for children.
Yeah.
As ways to tell, because it's somebody many, 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 many eons ago realized telling a child no doesn't make the child want to stop doing whatever you're telling them to not do.
Yeah.
But if you tell them a messed up story, and the point of the story isn't so explicit of not to do this, but it's kind of there for them to sort of like absorb, it works a lot better. Someone must have figured that out a long time ago. And there must be something to, like, scary stories must have originated with adults trying to scare kids out of doing stuff they weren't supposed to be doing.
It's essentially, and I realize why Luke said that, because he is a folklorist and he studies these stories and how they originate. It is a storytelling essentially swaying human behavior.
Because we just, and I won't dwell on this too much because he and I kind of briefly went over it, but that's what the movie The Village is about. Speaking of M. Night Shyamalan,
yeah.
people may not like that movie or think the ending is a little too much. The ending is sort of presented is almost a little too jokey. So I can understand people not liking it. But regardless, the point of that movie is, It's basically people telling scary stories to the kids as a way to save them. When you sort of understand what the end of that movie is, you're like, oh, they did all of this to preserve like goodness that they believed in. But the way they had to do to sort of preserve that is to create these like awful, horrible stories of these things so kids would never go into these woods.
You see, I don't see that as saving them, but rather keeping them within a society.
Yeah. And that's sort of in the theme of the movie too. Like, are they right or are they wrong?
Yeah.
But people like sort of trash the end of that movie. I get it. I get why. It's one of those like, no, you guys really need to go back and rewatch that. It's got some good stuff. You just have to understand that the ending is a little underwhelming. But the ending to Haunted School is not underwhelming. The ending to Haunted School was like, that was the most satisfying thing I've read in a while. To sort of just jump to get into it finally is...
Yeah, we are talking about the ending and never are we going to begin the story.
Yeah, the beginning of the story is this, he's the new kid in school. there's going to be some, like, because when I got to the end, like when I was thinking back, this is where, like, if you want to criticize listening to an audiobook, I was like, did they go over X, Y, and Z? Like, I don't remember this too clearly. Mm-hmm. But he's the new kid in school and he's trying to make friends. And so he's helping decorate for some kind of dance.
Yeah. Also, the main protagonist, Tommy, seems like kind of a sweet kid. Like, he came as a new guy to school and he wants to make friends. So he volunteered to be in this dance decorating organization, whatever, just to find friends.
And he befriends, is it the guy's name Ben?
Yeah,
is Ben. That right? Ben and Thalia.
Yeah, Thalia.
Now, does it say, because this was like, does she say that she's also a new kid?
No.
Is that?
I can't remember at all.
That, because when I, again, trying not to spoil too much, but that seems like something I kind of miss or felt like I missed whenever you get to the end. I was like, did she say she was a new kid? It felt like her and Ben were like besties.
And also, like, right at the start, this first chapter, so he references having a new mom. And this girl has two last names. And I asked you, like, why does a child have two last names? You know, that's usually when a woman gets married and wants to preserve her last name as well.
It happens a fair amount of it. Well, that's a whole other discussion. Like, most people don't do it, but something like Hispanic cultures do it a lot.
Ah, okay.
But then also, like, more, we'll say, more West Coast type people do it a lot as well, where a woman wants to not only preserve her, that she wants to preserve her maiden name, not fully take the man, like she'll take her husband's name, but she also wants to preserve her maiden name.
Okay. And she wants to preserve it with her daughter as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that was a South Park joke, I'm pretty sure, where they're in like San Francisco and like the husband's last name is like Jones and her, and the wife's last name is, well, I think his last name is like something like Jones Watson and hers is like Blake, whatever. So they named their kid Jones Watson Blake as their last name. So I think it's more West Coast type stuff, but
okay, let's not dwell on this too much because both of us are straight white guys.
Yeah. Well, what I say West Coast, more like not Hispanic, but like just a more West Coast thing for whatever reason. But anyway, he's the new kid. He meets what I thought was, it was Thalia and Ben. I thought they were like old besties or something, the way that their characters are. And like having known about what ultimately saves the characters in the end, whenever Thalia keeps bringing out her lipstick, I was like, oh, it's very, I was like, I like that that's being set up.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking at it like that. So I just remember the story starts talking about her putting on lipstick, but I guess I wasn't paying as close attention as I thought it was. I don't remember it saying that she was like putting on like all the makeup.
Okay. So they made a point of constantly bringing up how this girl is putting on makeup and lipstick and how she's caking her face in makeup, how everybody's making fun of her for doing that constantly. I went into this book blind. So I thought, okay, there is a reason for that, but okay, I'm reacting in real time. And this child obviously has some kind of OCD problem or a problem with self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Then I remembered a story you shared with me. I don't know if we should bring it up on the show, but we're going to bring it up by the end because it's a synchronicity.
Yeah. But again, I was shocked I didn't remember this part of the story because I was listening to it and I was like, I know where this is going. But it made me confused because, again, it had been 20 years, so my memory was somewhat rusty. And I just swore that it was the three of them from the beginning wound up in this other place. And so whenever the story starts happening and I'm listening to it now, I'm like, oh, it's only these two kids. I was like, I swore that she showed up. I was like, maybe she shows up towards the end, but I swore she was there the whole time. But like, we'll get to it. But the opening like chapter of this book is like, they're decorating for the dance. He's only doing it because he wants to make friends. And you're like, oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
And then they send him to like the third floor or something to the art room to get paint for something they need.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of winds up getting lost.
Yeah. But through the process of getting lost, he is also hearing voices of children.
Yeah. Hearing voices.
So like right at chapter 1, 2, 3, you're thinking, oh, it's a ghost story. But yeah. Then it goes into this weird realm where it goes into liminality of a school, because it's a giant school, three-story school. He gets lost. And that brought me back to childhood of the feeling of being small and in this giant architectural space. I mean, they were in this school after class. Like, this is almost nighttime. So after the school,
hours, yeah.
Yeah, after hours. So it is empty. This whole liminal space of a school empty in a liminal time period when the school is not active, you know.
Yeah. Now, the principal's there.
The principal
is not completely empty.
Yeah, but the liminality and then the voices and all that, it just felt very eerie to me. And that's why I like Goosebumps books. They convey these small minutiae that are kind of scary. It's not violence. It's not gore. It's not horror as we perceive it today. It is much more subtle.
And it sets up right in like the first chapter to kind of a very interesting lore to what the school is, because this kid, like, he gets lost and he winds up in a section of the school that he doesn't recognize, that looks older. And then he winds up in this classroom and it's filled with, like, that would be a creepy image. Like, I could see there would be a great movie to be made from this story, because he winds up in a classroom full of like these creepy statues. It's so like, it's just like an old classroom in an old part of the school that he wasn't familiar with. And it's full of like these eerie
lifelike mannequins. Statues.
Yeah. And then he gets startled by the principal, who shows up behind him, and she explains that they're the class of
1947.
And they all vanished, and no one knows what happened. And so a local artist designed all these statues kind of in their memory. They're like, it was so devastating. And you're like, I feel like any other corny story wouldn't have taken the time to sort of establish how crazy that is. But like, I like it in this book. They're like, it was so crazy that basically we had to shut down the school and then we built a new school around it.
And this is the first class when the school was originally opened in 1947 and they went missing. Also, I kind of called bullshit on that. Like, 25 kids going missing within the confines of a school. How does that happen?
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to start pulling threads at this, it's okay, not going to make sense.
But okay, it reminds me of the Roanoke colony that disappeared without a trace. So they're pulling off of that
thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, these kids all vanish without a trace. Nobody ever saw them again. Nobody knows what happened. But it was so tragic that they closed the school down. Instead of tearing it down, they just built around it. So I sort of love that visual, like the idea of like you're at a school and you just wind up in a part of the school that's like abandoned, that is creepy in its own right. And the lore to why it's there is like they couldn't quite let it go. They couldn't destroy it. So all these years, it is kind of still haunting the rest of the school.
And I should point out, we are not talking about Hogwarts.
No. and I guess I forgot, like, I thought all this was going to take place on this one night, but technically, like, he learns all this and he runs downstairs and he tells his new friends all this stuff, what he saw. And then it cuts to like the next day or so.
Also, and I wanted to point out, like, every chapter, as you know, in Goosebumps book, every chapter ends with a cliffhanger and the next chapter starts with a twist. So by the end of the chapter, he's like going into the gym and both of his friends are lying motionless on the floor. And
yeah,
end of chapter.
And even before that, like whenever he's in the classroom and sees the kids, he like feels something, like someone grabs him, and that's the end of the chapter.
Yeah.
And then the next chapter is like, oh, it's the principal. And then, like you said, yeah, he goes, runs downstairs and his friends are laying lifeless on the floor. And then the next one, it's like, oh, they were just taking a nap.
Yeah. Yeah. They were joking with him. Like, it took you so long that we fell asleep out of boredom. But what's the point of having every chapter end with a plot twist or a cliffhanger? Because what's the point of having chapters then? Then I'm going to immediately read the next chapter and the next and the next, and then I'm going to read the whole book. I'm not going to put it away for tomorrow.
I think because they're four children, it helps, especially when kids get familiar with the Goosebumps series, and they all kind of do that, the kids are sort of, they keep reading because they know there's going to be something at the end of each chapter that sort of strings them along a little more.
Also, there's the theme, I see it as that when reading Goosebumps books, every chapter when you read the book starts with a giant number of the chapter in slime. So it's kind of a countdown. The more you are reading the book and going through these cliffhangers, the more the plot is counting down.
I couldn't get that from the audio version. So, yeah, he's telling them this happened, and it cuts to the next day at school, and he's sitting in classroom, and that's, again, like you, because like you said, and I forgot to mention, he's hearing voices when he's in that part of the school, and then the next day when he's in his classroom, he hears them again. And he's like, where are these voices coming from? And and everybody's like, what are you talking about? Which really almost calls into question. I was like, has no one ever heard these voices besides him?
Also, I wanted to point out, so this day when he hears the voices again in his classroom, before that, there is a whole scene of bullying. R.L. Stein really, really properly conveys how bullying works. And I felt very uncomfortable. It's just, you know, a bigger girl trying to steal the lipstick from Talia and Talia losing her shit over that. I was like, Talia really has self-esteem, emotional issues. This is not funny. This is very tragic and fucked up.
Yeah, but also what's the bully girl's name?
Greta.
She's set up at the beginning of the story too, because Tommy, when he's getting lost in the school, he runs into her and she's kind of rude to him, but then she's also like, it doesn't present her as like solely a complete bully, because she's sort of rude to him, but then she's also kind of sort of, I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, almost she's vulnerable in her own right.
She seems to me like, I can bring myself back to like fifth grade. One of those girls which had a growth spurt before the rest of the class. So she's in that period when she feels vulnerable because she is going through changes in her body, and she looks much different than the classmates because she's the largest one in the class.
Yeah, she's kind of a bully, but she's also just kind of like a bit of an outcast because she kind of grew up a little bit quicker. So, and my point is, like, it doesn't present her as like just this solely cruel person at first. But then, yeah, there's this. And what exactly happens? Because she basically she just grabs Talia's lipstick or something? Is that all that happened?
Well, they fought over the lipstick, and then at one moment, Greta took the lipstick and drew a smiley face on Talia's forehead.
Oh, I didn't even catch that. This is why some of the problems of listening, like, I didn't catch that. But again, it's still a nice, like, it's not like, because if that wasn't in there and at the end of the book, you know, the lipstick comes back, you would just be like, oh, okay, I guess that's fine. But I like that it's sort of set up as a literal, like, piece of story.
And when the teacher comes back, and now Tommy, the protagonist, is hearing all these voices of children saying, help me, help me. I'm like, fuck that shit. This bullying is much more gut-wrenching than any fucking ghost voices. Yeah. But I remember a cool quote, like, the teacher told Tommy, like, you're too young to start hearing voices.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I wanted to write that down and literally forgot to do it. Like, you're too young to hear voices.
Is this kid displaying signs of schizophrenia now? And then the teacher is like, no, you're too young to be mentally ill.
Yeah. And then it kind of cuts to, I guess, that night where they're back. Because the dance is that night, basically. They're still back setting up. So it's Tommy, Ben, and Talia. They're finishing setting up. They're mentioning to Talia. They're like, why is the lipstick so important to you? And she's like, it's my favorite color, or something like that.
Yeah.
And then Tommy and Ben have to go grab something. I forget what it is they need.
Okay, so
Greta rips a decoration.
Yeah.
So they're going to look for tape or something like that.
Also, I should say the best band name, Grunt. It's a band with one drummer and six guitarists.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So they go back through the school, and Tommy thinks he knows a shortcut, even though he had just gotten lost the night before.
And even though he is the new kid,
yeah,
who does not know the school.
And Ben yelling at him like, no, don't blah, 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 blah. And they wind up basically back in the old part of the school again.
Yeah.
And find, now this is an odd sort of touch.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, nothing's technically haunted, but they find this elevator. And the elevator is one of the oddest things about the whole story in terms of what it does and how the hell it was even there and how it's doing what it's doing. But it's you don't need to try too hard to think about it because it might ruin the story. But
yeah, but it also seems so they found the elevator inside some room that was boarded up. And they accidentally got through the boards or the wall or something and found themselves in this place with the elevator. And it seems the elevator is like from 70 years ago. So probably, you know, 1947. And this was bullshit to me. I also called bullshit. Like an elevator you found just, you know, abandoned for 70 years and you want to go inside.
Nothing about the elevator makes a whole lot of sense. But it gets you to the next part of the story. It's the only reason it's really there. So yeah, they're in this abandoned part of the school and in an abandoned classroom, and they find an elevator and it actually it still works. And yeah, they decide to get in. Again, it's one of these like leaps of logic you have to sort of just go with because it's a kid's book. They get in.
And it closes and there is a whole chapter of them just trying to press all the buttons to get out and nothing happens.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was thinking, wow, is this maybe an elevator that traps children? And then the voices he's hearing are the trapped children because I did not know the plot beforehand.
Yeah. But I remembered that. So they finally hit what they think is the door open button. And then the elevator starts moving. But instead of going up and down, mm-hmm. it goes sideways.
Yeah.
And
that reminded me of the movie Cube, if you remember that one.
I've never seen Cube.
Yeah.
I know what it is, but I never saw it. So the elevator opens basically to like a pitch black room and they can't see anything. And they start like trying to get around and I think they hear that the elevator closes behind them and they can't find the light. And then they start hearing people's voices and then a light eventually gets clicked on. What they see is kind of would probably be kind of frightening. They're seeing the entire world is gray. Like it's a gray classroom with gray desks filled with children who are gray skin, gray hair. Their clothing is gray, a creepy visual. And they have no idea what's going on. They're scared and they try to run back to the elevator. They find that there's no button here to open they can't open the elevator back up and there's no button to do it. And they're stuck basically.
And then the children gang up on them and are like, oh, color, yeah. Color.
Yeah.
And then one girl takes away Tommy's shoe, and I need to go into folklore territory now because I mm-hmm. discussed this yesterday on my yesterday's episode with Stephanie Quick. She told mm-hmm. me there is a motif, and I'm aware in, let's say, fairy folklore or old school mythology that people who go to the underworld or the fairy realm lose a shoe, or that fairies like to take away shoes from people. She also told me it's a motif in shamanic initiations. When somebody goes to the dream realm or the underworld, they come back without a shoe. So I'm like, wow, they're taking away this guy's shoe. So a lot of these ties to the underworld, I don't know if it was intentional from R.L. Stein's side, but it is a folkloric motif.
I wonder if they did, because there's a whole plot piece in the movie Nope where one of the weirdest visuals in the entire movie that they do not explain is the movie opens and there's this violent thing that has happened. And then this character sort of focuses in. There's this shoe that's sitting in the middle of it. But it's sticking straight up, almost like unworldly. Like it's like almost like it's defying gravity. The shoe is just sticking straight up.
Yeah.
And he gets sort of fixated on it. And then that shoe sort of shows up later. It doesn't really have much of arguably there's a payoff, but it's something that he was so fixated on that he kept it and puts it in this little shrine. But it's so odd when you see it in the movie, because it just, it doesn't make sense of how it's sort of sticking up like that. So I wonder if that's where he got that.
There are a lot more motifs of people going into the underworld that we will go into later in this plot.
It also makes me, another tangent, Mad Max Fury Road, whenever he goes into the big dust storm in the movie, right before he goes in, one of his shoes gets torn off by someone trying to pull him off of a car.
Yeah.
But they only managed to get his shoe pulled off, and then he almost immediately goes into this huge dust storm.
It's very fascinating to me how taking away somebody's shoe is a motif that has been present for millennia, and we are now constantly seeing it in modern media as well, just used in a different way.
Yeah. Anyway, these kids sort of, they don't necessarily attack them, but they sort of just like crowd them, and they're touching them. And you sort of realize they're fixated on the color. And
as is R.L. Stine, because in every book, he needs to go into detail what everybody is wearing, what color it is, what color the sun is. He is obsessed with colors. So it makes sense to me that he would base a whole book's plot around colors like this one.
So eventually the kids back off. And I don't really want to go into every like one of these kids, but they're basically, what you realize is these are the missing kids from 1947, and they've been stuck here since 1947. And they have this little setup. They're like, well, how did we get here? They're like, we really don't know, but we're pretty sure it was Mr. Chameleon.
The most bullshit name.
Yeah. But it kind of works because it sort of sets him up as like an almost otherworldly presence. Which makes sense because he kind of shows up in the end, and you're just like, maybe he himself is not human.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, Mr. Chameleon is an evil man. He hated children, but he was the only photographer in town.
So what can you do, eh?
Yeah. So he took their like school dance photo or whatever 50 years ago. And that's the last they all, like, they just remember him taking the photo, and then they were all in this this classroom. And they're basically stuck in time, so they haven't aged. And the photograph, like, you realize their color, they all, you know, had actual color to them, and it all faded as they stayed longer and longer in this gray world.
Also, if you have a guy who's alone with children in a room, and he takes their photo, and immediately 25 children go missing, aren't you going to look into the guy?
Yeah, I guess so. This is Goosebumps, man. I can't imagine most of these stories make sense.
Yeah.
So, these kids are basically stuck in time, and they don't age, and they're all their colors drained away. So they're gray, just like the world around them. And one thing that I forgot about it, completely forgot with the story, is how it sort of expands I just remembered it was the classroom they were sort of stuck in, but that's not technically true. That's when I said it's got this Stranger Things upside down sort of quality to it, which, I mean, Stranger Things didn't invent that by any stretch, but you sort of realize that's why we said earlier, it's not really a haunted, it's not really ghost. It's a other dimension thing. It's almost, it's almost like Lovecraftian sort of.
Okay. So the children tell them, these gray children tell Tommy and is it Ben or whoever, that they are on the other side of the walls. And then in my head, I'm like, we don't need no education.
I was thinking more of a Hellraiser. Because like walls just open up in those movies to like a hell demon or a hell dimension.
Well, we're going to go into that later.
Yeah. So they're like, yeah, it's sort of a clunky metaphor he uses, but it gets the point across. He's like, have you ever seen a wall that you just wondered what's on the other side of it? And I was like, no, I've never thought that.
Well, that goes with the theme of the elevator going sideways. Like, this is a dimension. This is a parallel dimension. It's not above us or below us. It is beside us.
Yeah. And yeah, like you said, he's like, we're what's on the other side of the wall. So yeah, we're not in a ghost world. These kids aren't ghosts. They've been trapped in this weird dimension that itself is kind of its own world. Because again, I thought it was just the classroom. But as you go along, you realize like, you know, Tommy and Ben are just, you know, like, we're not going to be stuck here. We're going to find a way out. For whatever reason, they can't get out of the door, but they instead escape out the window.
And yeah, there is this outer world around the school.
Yeah.
But it reminds me of, I mean, this cool idea that if you take a photo, you're creating a pocket dimension, because this is a essentially a pocket dimension. It's not necessarily the whole town, but just the radius around the school. Everything is surrounded in mist.
Yeah, but there's a cat out there. That was a random thing. Like, oh, there's a cat out here. That's weird. But another thing, and we didn't even really establish. So as these kids are telling the Tommy and Ben in the classroom what happened to them, at a certain point, like, Tommy looks down at his own hands and realizes that he's turning gray. And the kids, they set up their own rules, so you just sort of have to go with it. The kids basically just say, like, yeah, once you turn gray, you're stuck gray forever. So keep that in mind as we get towards the end of the
book.
This
was very terrifying to me. If you think about it, like, in horror movies, the trope is, oh, we need to hurry because we're going to die. This room is flooding and the water will go up, or something like that, you know, or you're losing your blood, losing your life force, whatever. Even sometimes you're going invisible, like you're fading away from existence. But think about it. If you are slowly losing color, I mean, nothing's really happening to you, but that would be so fucking terrifying.
Yeah. And well, and that's what's happened. Like, they realize they're losing color. And so now that sort of sets up, if you want to call it, the ticking time bomb or the ticking clock element to the story.
Yeah.
So they've got to find a way out. So they, like, dash out the window and wind up into sort of the, again, I like that it wasn't just, because I remembered it was just the classroom. I forgot all about this other stuff. And I really, it became some of the more interesting stuff where I was like, oh, it's not just this idea. Like, R.L. Stine ran with it and said, oh, well, it's not only just this other crazy dimension world outside the classroom. But then he also does, like, a nice sort of character thing where you realize half of the class escaped and they're in these different factions now.
Oh, yeah. It's funny that you brought up Mad Max.
Yeah, because there were however many kids in the that went missing. Half of them basically said, we're not staying in this school. We're going to leave and go form our own little thing if we have to be stuck here.
And then they went crazy.
Yeah, and they went crazy.
So listen, kids, don't escape school. Stay in the school because you're going to go mad.
Yeah, but I like that because it was something like this. The story didn't need it. It's just one of those things like, oh, it's a nice little writer tangent that he put in there that sort of gives it a little bit more, I don't know, like, you buy into it a little bit more. And they run into these crazy kids who kind of ambush them and start doing this weird chant at them where they're just like, turn, turn, turn.
Oh, it's not just a chant. They are dancing in circles around them.
Yeah.
And this goes into fairy folklore again, the concept of a fairy ring. When you are in a fairy ring, then time is fucked up. There are legends from medieval ages of people dancing with fairies in fairy rings, and like a whole night of dancing would pass by, and when they get out of the fairy ring, like 100 years passed in the real world and they'd crumble to dust. This motif in the book reminded me of fairy rings, fairies dancing in circles around people. And they were chanting like, turn, turn, turn. And then eventually they're like, turn to gray, turn to gray.
Yeah.
So they are
basically
kinda,
it's the gobble gobble one of us.
Yeah.
Type thing.
And they're dancing in circles around the kids, waiting for them to turn into them.
Yeah.
Another motif, if you go into the underworld or the fairy realm, and if you stay there for a long time, you are going to become one of them.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm vaguely familiar with that idea.
That idea will come back now when you go into the next.
They're turning more and more gray, and they eventually escape away from these kids. I forget how they do it. I don't remember what they did to actually get away, because they tried and then the kids stopped them, but then something, I think maybe the other kids showed up.
Well, you're not going to go into the dark black pit.
Did I miss that?
Was it in the audiobook version? So they
maybe it was, and I just
they try to run away out of this ring, but can't. So the kids get them up a hill, into the edge of a dark black pit that has bubbling black sludge inside of it. And then these gray kids start taking cups and filling the cups with this black sludge, drinking it, pouring it over each other, spitting it into each other's faces. You don't remember this?
No.
Oh, wow. This was a fucked
up
scene.
For all I know, you're making this shit up because no, I don't remember
this. No, this is in the book, man. You need to go back. It's like a whole with black sludge.
Okay. I'm bleeping that, by the way. Yeah, I don't remember that at all. So how did the other kids show up and save them? Is that right?
Okay, so they were trying to force these two kids to drink the black sludge. Again, there's the motif, if you eat fairy food, you will be stuck in fairy forever. Or if you go into the underworld, if you eat or consume anything from the underworld, you will stay there forever and turn into them.
Hmm.
Also, if you know from the Odyssey, the Greek myth, there is the motif of the lotus eaters. Are you aware of that? There was a whole island of people who were constantly consuming the flower of a lotus. And they went crazy because of that and did not want to go off the island or be saved.
Sounds sort of familiar.
Yeah. So it is insinuated that this group of children who are kind of crazy are crazy because they're consuming the black sludge.
Yeah. I'll have to go revisit that because, wow, I don't remember that at all.
So eventually they want to drop these two boys into the bog pit. And then the other kids, the ones from the classroom, come and save them. And they're like, yeah, we are bringing you back to the classroom. We can't save you, but at least you're going to be safer in school.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they wind up back in the classroom. And Tommy has a last ditch idea of like, well, maybe the flame from my lighter, which he's carried around the whole time, maybe that'll help bring color back. But it doesn't. he lights it up finally, and it's a gray flame. So they're sort of like, it's this all is lost moment, and then they hear the elevator. And this brings in, like, again, I did not remember this. And the whole time I'm, like, listening to this book, I'm like, where is Tali? I was like, I swear to God she was here the whole time. And I swear that she's the one that saves them in the end. And that's all I remembered of her character. I didn't remember what happened next, where the elevator opens. And at first, right before they get to the elevator, the kids briefly state, well, one of us did escape.
Yeah.
They finally say one kid did get out. And at first they think it's Greta. And I can't really recall what made them think, because he said something like she had gray eyes or something. I was like,
She had gray eyes and was wearing black all the time. Because if she's a goth, then surely she needs to be a weirdo from another dimension.
But I don't remember early in the story them saying she had gray eyes. But right when they think that's what's going on, they're like, oh, it's Greta. She's the one, because she's so odd anyway.
Yeah.
And she has gray eyes and dresses in black and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, she's from here. And then the elevator opens. And out walks Talia. And me, as the person who's read this before, I was like, oh, there, finally, Talia's here. She's going to bring the lipstick thing, because that's been set up, and she's going to save them. I did not remember this next part. And I was so, so happy I didn't remember it, because it was like the twist of the book where I was like, holy shit. Of course, like it truly, like the M. Night Shyamalan, like it was there the whole time.
And the funny thing is, right at the first few chapters, when we were introduced to the gray kids, I sent you a message on Instagram and I told you this is going to happen. And I did not read the book.
Yeah, you had called it.
Yeah.
So you realize that Talia was the girl that escaped, and that she like, and as these kids say, like the rule actually holds true. Once you're gray forever. So that's why she's so fixated on her makeup. She is constantly putting it on, because if she doesn't, it'll all kind of gray away. And you realize she's the girl that escaped, and she's been trying. And that's where I'm like, I almost need to go back and reread it just to see if it established that she was new as well. Cause it only says she'd escaped like a couple weeks ago.
Oh yeah, and the black tar pit is another reason why you should go back.
Yeah.
That is just a fucking weird scene.
So yeah, Talia shows up, and when she opens up, she's like, oh, I found, she had been talking about, she'd been trying to find a way back, but couldn't. And then she explains how she escaped was she'd found this lipstick at the bottom of her purse that had been there for 50 years, sealed up, and still had its color. And she decided she was going to draw on the wall with it. But instead of like just putting color there, it basically burned a hole in the wall. So she basically used the colored lipstick to
create a portal.
Create a portal back to the real world, and escaped, and had every intention of like trying to get back, but she couldn't find her way back. But she found it because she went looking for Tommy and Ben, found where they'd like burst through a little hole, and then found the elevator, which there's no way she would have been. Maybe she was able to piece that together because she technically would have seen at least the other side of the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, slight logic leaps, but again, it's fine.
I also like the theme. Like, she says that her lipstick remained red because it was closed, sealed. So it's like this world is being exposed to some kind of ether that is sucking out the color.
Yeah.
It's not technically that everything inside that world is gray, but is being exposed to something that's sucking out the color.
It's sort of almost like Schrodinger's cat too, where as long as it's in there, it might be safe. But if you open it, you're sort of going to damn yourself. So
I honestly thought, because the chapter ended there when she was opening the lipstick, I thought she's going to open the lipstick and the lipstick will either be gray or it will be run out because she was constantly using the lipstick on her lips.
And then to me, the biggest logic leap comes right here, because she basically says, like, I can open another portal and you, Tommy and Ben, can escape. And you're just like, well, all of these kids can go now. But the logic leap is like, no, we're going to stay. And I was like, nobody would make that decision. I don't care how gray you are, and if that's how you have to live the rest of your life.
Oh,
like,
really?
You are in this nothing world where there's like almost no happiness. There's everything's gray. You don't eat. You don't do. You're just existing timelessly, and you have no effect on anything.
Well, like, I want to say this. So last episode we did was Frankenstein. And remember how bright a Frankenstein ended? And it's a black and white movie. Frankenstein, the monster said, we belong dead.
Yeah, but these are kids, man. Like, I just couldn't. Because what Talia basically says is she's been living back in reality for a couple weeks. And she's just like, she's like, I don't belong there is what she's saying.
Yeah, she cannot pretend to be who she isn't.
Yeah,
here's where we bring this up. Another fucked up thing. So they ask her, how do you have blue eyes then? And she says, well, I used contact lenses. When I was thinking about this girl going through self-esteem issues, which is very prevalent in, you know, teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered a case that you had, and you can cut this out if you want. You had, when you worked as a death investigator, you told me a suicide of a teenage girl. And you said it was a very, very sad thing when you realized she had cheap blue contact lenses in her eyes.
Yeah.
And there's this synchronicity. I was thinking about that at the beginning of the book, and now by the end they say blue contact lenses, and I'm like, wow, that's weird.
I don't mind mentioning it, but it's such a downer of a thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Because I've told this story, I forget who, I think I told it on Autopsy, where someone asked, like, what was a story that stuck with you? And I was like, well, this is one of the saddest cases, not because it was necessarily super brutal, but it was basically a suicide of like an 11 or 12 year old girl. I'm really bringing down the room here, but
it is already a downer to me going through this book, because I was going mentally into that state of, I'm back in my childhood, fifth, sixth grade, and what I was going through. And I can empathize with this girl if she has some kind of self-esteem issues and is fixated with the lipstick. It is also something my own sister is going through, though she is now eighth grade. But she is constantly putting on makeup because of the same self-esteem issues. So it is something that...
And it was also the story I dealt with or yeah. the case I dealt with, it was bullying involved with this girl. So again, not to go into too much detail, but the reason I always remembered it is she dyed her hair. Like, you could just tell the girl didn't like anything about herself. She dyed her hair because she didn't like her hair, and she had this like frizzy blonde, overly blonde hair. And then the contacts were the things that sealed it. This is why I remembered it, because when you looked at her, like, you looked at her eyes, and her eyes looked so weird. Like, mm-hmm. they didn't look real. And then we realized she was wearing these super cheap looking contacts. Because she was, she was fairly poor. So it was all she could really get her hands on.
And that's the wonder of child horror literature, especially Goosebumps. As I said, conventional modern horror for adults is very in your face. But with these books, you are touching upon themes that are much more subtle, but take your mind to places, especially if you go back to your childhood and remember what it was like. That's why we are discussing a Goosebumps book, which is a children's book, on a horror podcast.
Yeah. But back to, but that wraps up kind of like Talia, where she's like, I'm here to stay. She's like, I'm not going to go back. But still, the rest of the kids immediately go along with it. And I was like, no. I was like, maybe Talia had a change of heart being back in the real world, but the rest of the kids would at least want to, like, at least try their hand, and they could always come back because they know the elevator now. She's like, we're just going to stay.
At least the girl who is constantly sneezing, because there is some girl that is sneezing and like has a cold. And I'm thinking, if they are stuck in time, this girl has had this cold for 70 fucking years.
Yeah. So basically what Talia says is, since Tommy and Ben, they're almost completely grayed out, but they still have some color left. So she's like, I'll use my lipstick and I'll draw the hole again, and you two can escape, and we're going to stay. So that's what she does. And then when they escape, they wind up in like the boys' bathroom or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The whole, like, whenever they escape through this portal, it brings them to, like, I think boys' bathroom, I think.
And it brings them to this same night when they went missing. So
yeah,
it's like no time went by.
Yeah, well, they haven't really been in this world that long,
mm-hmm.
if you think about it. Like, they showed up in the elevator. It maybe, I don't know, half an hour or so, they realizing that their skin's turning. They try to escape. I mean, a lot happens in the span of, like, maybe the hour that they were gone. But yeah, they wind up right back at the dance. And then that leads to sort of the final little R.L. Stein, like, twist, gotcha, whatever you want to, a little zinger to leave you with. I think it's the principal finds them, and she's like, all right, you two, like, we've been looking everywhere for you, Tommy and Ben, we want you part of the picture too. So she brings them to the room where all these kids are sort of posing for a photo, and she puts Tommy and Ben in the back, and then the principal says, okay. She's like, we're good, Mr. Chameleon. You can take your photo now. The last thing that you sort of read is Tommy realize, like, Mr. Chameleon, wait, no. And then you hear like flash or something like that. And then boom, that's the end of the story.
I love how it's abrupt.
It's, the person, I'm the guy that loves the ambiguous Carpenter endings. So when you see this and that's all you get and you don't know what happens next, you're like, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Like, this book was great. Like, I remember really liking it when I was a kid. And I was like, again, I wasn't sure how much Goosebumps books would hold up, because if for no other reason than R.L. Stein was churning these things out, and you're just like, well, when you do that, you tend to lose quality being that prolific. But It held. I don't know how much other books hold up, but this one really held up.
I love that stinger in the end, because this whole twist is just a few lines at the end, and it came out of nowhere. Yeah. It's just, okay, Mr. Chameleon, you can take the picture, and it's Tommy. No, and flash. That's it.
Yeah. It's a great, like, it would be like a really good, like, campfire ghost story to tell kids or something.
Yeah.
Which is, again, going back, this is, there has to be some history that I don't know about that Luke might know of, like, this is clearly, this is where horror began, was trying to scare children, because I can't imagine telling stories, one adult trying to scare another adult. Like, it must have all come from, like, trying to mess with kids, to teach them a lesson or make them learn something, because it doesn't, it's always kind of been there. Like, even like some of the best children's fiction has super dark pieces of it, going all the way back to like Disney and Bambi. Like, the movie opens with a lot of Disney movies open with a parent being murdered, usually in front of the child.
As I said, the motif of losing your color here, it is not something violent. It's not something gory, you know, but it is terrifying if you think about it. So I like children's literature because it deals with a very harsh subject matter, but through more mundane things. Mundane at first, yeah. But when you think about it, it's a very terrifying thought.
Yeah. And I don't know, because I didn't really take notes for any of this, so I don't have too much more by way of...
Okay, so the notes. Ambiguity of the end. It's just a flash, and you don't know what happened. It can be that it was just a picture taken, and that's that, and everybody has a happy ending. Or it could be that they are stuck in their own parallel dimension.
Could be, but even that has a glimmer of like, well, at least they know the rules.
Yeah, but also Mr. Chameleon, like, if you think about it, this guy is, what, 90 years old now?
Something like that.
It introduces the motif that maybe there is something there happening otherworldly, because if he is so old, he is definitely not a human, but rather some kind of entity.
Yeah, and he clearly has some sort of mysterious camera that he's using. But yeah, and it doesn't explain it, and that's fine.
I love how we learn of him through dialogue from other children, what other children are telling us about him. He never appears in the book except for this end, and at the very end, and we never get any description of him or nothing. It's just other people referencing him being there.
Yeah, just saying he's a mean old man that hated children. That's all anyone ever says about him.
Freddy Krueger vibes.
Yeah, and I don't remember much for as far as like other Goosebump books. Did R.L. Stine have like an interconnected universe? Did characters in some books show up in other books?
Not really.
No.
No.
Okay.
That's only good. Interconnected universe is in the video games, but not in the books.
There's Goosebump video games?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, I don't even remember that. And you know what? I kind of like that, though, because in this day, like, I grew up reading Stephen King, and a lot of his stuff is interconnected. And now everything these days is its own, you know, a Marvel universe, a DC universe. Yeah. It's like, you know, sometimes it's nice just to have a story that's its own story, even though technically it's part of a series. But
well, that's why when we discussed the X-Files, why I like the X-Files. I mean, it is technically all interconnected, but every episode is a thing for itself. But you still have this kind of interconnectedness that is very loose.
Yeah. And I guess Goosebumps also is sort of like a kid's version of Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Because none of these are really connected. They tell their own little stories that are kind of one and done. Although there are some stories do have sequels. So there's at least two Say Cheese and Die. There's probably, I think there was a Haunted Mask too.
Yeah, there's Monster Blood, four parts of Monster Blood. And then like 20 books of Night of the Living Dummy.
Yeah. Oh God, I forgot about Night of the Living Dummy. Yeah, so he made sequels, but he didn't really have interconnectedness, which is, again, maybe that's why, like, because I grew up seeing some episodes of Twilight Zone, but I don't think I really grew to love and appreciate it till I was probably in my 20s. And by then, I'd already known, like, Goosebumps. So it was almost like I'd grown up with the kids' version of Twilight Zone.
Yeah. Also, it's interesting that Ray Bradbury was mentioned in this book.
Oh, yeah, I did. And I wrote that to you, and I forgot to even mention it. Yeah, Tommy mentions, like, he had to do a book report or something. He wasn't much for, like, science fiction is what he says, but he really liked the stories of Ray Bradbury. And I messaged you. I was like, R.L. Stine called him by name. I was like, because he's wearing his influences on his sleeve.
Yeah.
But really, from what this story is, like, it does feel kind of Lovecraftian. So I'm sure Stine had lots of influences. And honestly, he's so old now that he's kind of influenced others.
And again, he takes like Ray Bradbury or Twilight Zone or Lovecraftian stuff and kind of, I want to say, purifies it into a condensed form for children.
Yeah. Yeah.
Distills it in a way.
And there's something else I was going to say about that. Ray Bradbury.
So did Ray Bradbury actually write a lot of literature for children? Because I'm not aware.
Wait, do what now?
Did Ray Bradbury write a lot of literature for children?
I think he did. Definitely Something Wicked This Way Comes, one of his more famous novels, is a kid's book. It's kind of my favorite thing that he's written and one of my favorite books ever written, because it's its own kind of like Goosebumps, except it's an actual more longer novel based, because it's not super graphic and gory. It's these children who get swept up into this sort of ghoulish carnival that's inviting to children. And then you sort of realize it's very, very nefarious. If you've never read the book or
I haven't, the movie. But it reminds me of the Disney's Pinocchio cartoon and that whole circus thing going around where the boys are being transformed into donkeys.
Yeah, Pinocchio probably came first as far as story goes, because in Something Wicked, the kids get on, an adult can get on a merry-go-round and it starts spinning backwards. And the longer they stay on it, the younger they get. They don't turn into other things, but they basically become like children again. And that's sort of the whole allure of what it is, because one of the main kid's father in the book had children, or had the main kid late in life. So he's an older guy. So he's sort of kind of enchanted by the idea that he could be younger again. But it also works both ways. If it starts going backwards, you get younger. But if it goes forward, you get older. And one of the other kids in the story, there's two main kids. There's Will and there's Jim. And Jim is like, that would be a whole great discussion if you'd read the book, because Jim is the one who grew up like, Will has a mother and father, and Jim only has his mother. And it never says exactly what happened to his father, but he's not in the picture. And because of that, like, Jim is the character in the story that wants to grow up. He doesn't want to be a kid. He's kind of got this way about him where he's a little smarter than most kids. And you sort of infer that that's because he's had to grow up a little faster because he doesn't have a father.
Yeah.
So he just wants to be grown. So he wants to get on the merry-go-round to grow up. And Will's father wants to get on it to sort of be younger again.
It's nice, but how I mentioned Cuckoo Clock of Doom, another Goosebumps book, and we're talking now about that, because the theme of this Goosebumps book is a child aging in reverse, so getting younger and younger. And by the end of the book, he is a baby, and he needs to do something to try and stop this. It's not a scary book, but it is a very, very Twilight Zone-ish sci-fi story. It's a very good book.
It's kind of that Benjamin Button type thing. Interesting.
Yeah, but only like throughout the story, his sister is pulling pranks on him and causing these situations where he is embarrassed. And now when he goes back to those times, he knows that and he tries to stop it, but causes another sequence of events where the same thing happens again. And then there is a sequence like, oh, I remember being on this tree. This is the day where I broke my arm. Oops. And then he breaks his arm again.
I don't know if I got anything else for Goosebumps that we haven't kind of already went over.
Well, do you remember any other books from the series?
Off the top of my head, no. I'd have to, I'm sure if I started glancing through titles, I might remember some of it. I remember an episode of the show. I don't know if I read the book, but it's these two kids. It's a older sister and a younger brother. I don't remember exactly what happens to them, but by the end of the book, you realize that they're these like two like royalty kids where they've forgotten who they were. And the whole story has been trying to pull them back to like, God, I can't think of what the name of it is. But by the end, like they're in like, he's like a king and, or she's a queen and he's a prince or something like that. And she's like, now I remember. And he's like, so do I. It's so terribly acted. I can't remember the name of it. I'd have to look through the titles of Goosebumps.
Also, that does not sound very horror-esque. But
no,
that's
it's real stupid.
That's the appeal of Goosebumps. Like, every book is a different thing for itself. Like, Cuckoo Clock of Doom is a very sci-fi time travel story. This, which we did now, The Haunted School, is not a ghost story, but rather a parallel dimension story, Lovecraftian.
Yeah, I just Googled here. I think Welcome to Camp Nightmare. I sort of remember that one.
Okay, that one is with a monster, and it was a two-parter on the TV show.
I remember seeing a lot of these covers, but I don't know if I read a lot of these.
I also want to comment, so this book, which we covered now today, is a very good book and a very great story. The marketing team around it was trash. and then you have something like The Werewolf of Fever Swamp. I don't know why that book is so popular, why everybody loves it. I read it recently. It is atrocious. It's so bland and boring. It's like any werewolf story ever. And whole chapters are dedicated to Stein just describing the colors of the swamp or the trees or stuff like that, you know? Mm-hmm. It's so boring. That book was heavily promoted, spawned lots of merchandise, stuff like that. And yet this book is totally obscure and is probably one of the best stories.
Yeah. And another, like, going back to like Goosebumps and going back to the 90s, another sort of like good companion to this back then was we always had Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yeah.
On like every Saturday, like, that's one of those things where I am nothing but an old man now having to think about all this, because it's like kids these days do not understand. Like, back then, yeah, we didn't just have like cool books like Goosebumps. Every Saturday you got to sit and watch Are You Afraid of the Dark on Nickelodeon. And Nickelodeon had like some of the best kids content like ever made. Not just that stuff, but like their cartoons, like the stuff they would put out. Like, it was like truly the best of times.
And also on the Cartoon Network side, if you remember Courage the Cowardly Dog, which was a kind of horror-esque cartoon.
Yeah. And I remember mostly from Cartoon Network, I remember Dexter's Laboratory, which I remember liking that show, but even back then, I remember it was annoying to watch, because the way Cartoon Network set up so much stuff was you'd get like 2 minutes of a show and then there'd be like a 5 minute commercial break every time. Yeah. Like, it just felt like you were constantly watching commercials.
Well, a lot of, especially because you were also an 80s kid, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the show, which everybody loves from the 80s, is essentially a commercial for toys.
Oh, well, yeah, 100%. But I guess people don't really realize these days that, yeah, in the 80s, like, yeah, everything was a toy. And then they basically created toys or created TV shows just so they could create toys, which is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but also Transformers.
Yeah, and also like those Street Sharks or whatever. They made so many different cartoons just to sell toys.
Yeah, like that's where people like, I don't know if they just don't understand, like, because Star Wars these days, like Star Wars was created originally as a movie, but then it took off into like the marketing and the toys that they made from it. They don't do that anymore, where they create something just to create a toy out of it. Where, yeah, like I don't understand anyone's like love of Transformers, because it was always ever just meant to be a toy.
I want to ask you this.
There's nothing to it.
I want to ask you this. So there is a disconnect between R.L. Stein, who is the creative force behind Goosebumps, and the marketing team, because Goosebumps was heavily marketed. All the books had these flashy art pieces that have nothing to do with the plot.
Yeah.
A lot of merchandise was spawned. So how many children do you know who actually read the books compared to those who were buying the merchandise and kind of like, oh, I love Goosebumps, but never read a book?
Probably a lot, because they were just cool little, like, almost trinkets to have.
Yeah.
Like, they brightened up your room if you bought it. But yeah, I think a lot of people would probably just buy them just to kind of have and maybe not read them, because it was so, I don't know. I don't know why people would do that. I mean, technically, there's a ton of books I have that I just haven't read that I own
Yeah.
that are on my list forever to read.
Also, I want to say R.L. Stine seems not to be a total sellout. Like, he really did a good job writing a lot of the books and pumping out a new book every month. It's just Scholastic, the publisher, that's using his property to market. So even though this was a pop cultural, you know, huge thing, especially after the 80s when you had bullshit shows like Transformers and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which were just marketing, you know, the whole point was marketing. There is something to these books and people should give them a chance despite them being a huge pop cultural thing. It's not a total sellout thing. There is something
there. Yeah. And because that's what I was afraid of. I was afraid that going back and reading this stuff, I was like, it's not going to hold up, but it really does. Like, there's true, like you see, like, oh, he is an actual writer. Cause if he was a sellout, he wouldn't just put the,
he wouldn't put the Ray Bradbury reference.
Yeah. He wouldn't do that, but he also wouldn't do like a little tangent where they escape and you realize there's different factions of kids in this world.
Yeah.
Like that's a writer thing. That's not something you're doing if you're just trying to sell books.
Yeah.
Compared to whenever I was thinking back before I went and reread this and was thinking about Goosebumps as a whole, it is, to me, it almost defied logic where I was like, was R.L. Stine, did he actually write all of this, or did he, or was it just a pen name?
Oh, ghostwriters, not just a haunted school.
Yeah, because that's like one of the series that I read a lot growing up was the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew books. And Hardy Boys, every time you read a book, they all say written by Franklin W. Dixon, but that's not a real person.
Okay, I think R.L. Stine really did write all the books because you can see his dry humor throughout every book. You can see the same themes going on, and especially his obsession with colors.
Yeah, that was sort of my, I mean, I eventually realized like, yeah, he did do that. And that, and there is respect to that, but like, it's just kind of hard to believe because it's like, he put out so much. And especially like, cause I didn't learn till later that like years after I'd stopped reading Hardy Boys that it was almost never the same writer.
Oh, do you remember Animorphs? That's a very 90s.
Yeah. Thing. Well, yeah, that's very 90s.
Only the first few books were written by the creators and then everything was just a ghostwriter.
Hmm. I guess there is something to be said for R.L. Stine then. If he wrote all this stuff, then good on him, because almost nobody has done what he's done, including Stephen King, who's prolific himself.
Well, a huge sign that he's not a total sellout is all of these writers who have ghostwriters using their name. When you look at their picture, they're smiling with white teeth, and this guy is looks like he wants to die.
Yeah. It's kind of the John Carpenter. Like John Carpenter, if you've ever seen him,
yeah,
he looks way older than, well, he's finally catching up to how he looks. He has looked in his late 70s for like the past 40 years. Like he has always looked like a corpse.
So props to R.L. Stine, because when you see that face, you know that this guy has been pumping books every month for decades.
He does nothing else with his life. Yeah. So yeah, props to R.L. Stine. And I think that's all there really is to say about the Haunted School.
I mean, this is the most attention the Haunted School has ever gotten since it came out.
Yeah, I'm curious to listen to it, because you said there's other podcasters that have touched on the book. I'm curious how much attention they gave to it.
They did not like it. They thought it was boring. And I'm like, fuck that. Now we're going to make an episode that redeems this book.
Yeah. Screw those people. This book is great. And again, that's shocking to me because I went into this like, oh, I had rose colored, you know, glasses on thinking about it. So it was probably good when I was a kid. And like a lot of stuff, it doesn't hold up. And I'm not saying it's a perfect book. There's things where you're just like, that doesn't make sense. But it pulls you along and it keeps you engaged. And it's got such a brilliant twist at the end that you're just like, oh, like there's like genuine like craftsmanship that I would even say that many other Goosebump books probably didn't have.
Yeah.
So screw those people. Check out The Haunted School. It's one of the best Goosebump books ever. And it'll make. And I have to go watch the show now. If they actually made an episode of it, I kind of have to go watch it.
I think it's a Disney Plus show from last year.
Jesus Christ. All right. Well,
because Goosebumps is now Disney property, I think.
God, is it?
I don't know, man.
That's a shame. Anyway.
Now you're going to start seeing Captain America in it. Maybe Mulder and Scully too, because Disney bought, you know, Fox.
Yeah, screw all that. Read The Haunted School, guys. It's great, and it'll make you brave. And until next time, thank you, Vuk, for coming on again.
Bye-bye, guys.